Hey there, welcome to our live Academy AMA sessions where we chat with awesome experts on specific SaaS related topics to bring more value to the SaaS community and hopefully share some unique knowledge. So today with me is Juan Ignacio, the founder of L40, M&A advisory for founders, and Pavel, our own head of M&A from SaaS Group. So we are here to cover both sides of the deal. So we'll basically go over some of the things that founders are asking one and the team when they're on the sales side, and how we deal with it and how we are trying to help founders on our buyer side. But, you know, before we get there, because we got a few questions already, yeah, maybe your background, a little bit about yourself. Juan, let's start with you.
Sure. I would say I'm not your out-of-the-mill banker. I spent a lot of years in banking. I was also an investor at a private equity firm. I co-founded two companies. One of them scaled to become a big unicorn. And then since a couple of years ago, I'm closing the loop, I'm back into M&A advisory. And so in a nutshell, what L40 does, we're a small firm with three partners, offices in Madrid, Lisbon, and Miami. We help founders exit their business. We're specialized in B2B SaaS, in general tech businesses, but B2B SaaS is the bread of what we do, the bread and butter of what we do. Geography agnostic, Europe and North America mostly. And yeah, we're here to help.
Perfect. Pavel?
Awesome. Well, I guess I've been buying and selling companies for almost 15 years. Going back to, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I used to be a sell-side advisor. Then I spent 5.5 years in private equity, investing primarily in large-scale situations in the U.S. And then 6 years ago, I decided to kind of kickstart my corporate career. And I spent a couple of years at Constellation Software before I got approached by the founders of SaaS Group to help them scale the business. So that was almost 4 years ago. Fast forward, I've built a team. We are now 7 people, fully remote in Europe. And actually, we just got our first Canadian hire. And together with the team in the last 4 years, we brought more than 15 brands to SaaS Group. And we're looking to bring another 20, 30 in the next 40 years. And I really think we have a really tremendous positioning in the market. We're one of a few platforms that are sector agnostic, business model agnostic, focusing on product-led growth, software companies in Western Europe and the US, buying companies with revenues between $2 and $10 million, businesses that are highly capital efficient, growing, and usually have very small, highly efficient teams. Super excited to be here and also talk to you, Juan.
Yeah, I can definitely see a match. So Juan, you're probably talking to quite a few companies that actually fit our profile. So that will be really useful for us too. So, you know, maybe before we jump to some of the questions that I already got, what are the questions that you typically hear from founders who are looking to sell? Like, what is the biggest, oh my God, what do I do here? Juan, what are you approached with?
Well, I think typically they ask about valuation. They want to understand whether metrics are right for the businesses to sell at the point in time that they're on. They want to understand how buyers think in terms of what the process looks like, what will they have to, I don't know, go through extensive due diligence. I think that the typical questions. Then there's a lot of anxiety around the role after the acquisition, whether they will continue running the business, whether they will have to leave, whether the buyer will have good intent or not with them. That's also very, very typical. I guess that's kind of the usual questions that a founder may have at a point in time in which there comes an existential move for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Pavel, at what point do founders usually approach you when they have an advisor or when they're still alone, kind of just tinkering with the idea? And are their questions then different?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that half of the companies we buy, they are bought on a proprietary basis, meaning we approach the founders, we build a relationship with them for up to 5 years, usually it's 3 to 5 years on average. And usually those people, they know they're going to sell at some point. They roughly have a number in mind and they're trying to grow into that price by trying to grow their top line and EBITDA. I completely agree with Juan. I would say that every single call that we have, the founders ask, you know, what's the price? Because I think people get approached all the time by buyers and they just want to know roughly where the value is. And I think for me, it's less about the price. It's less more about finding the right buyer because, you know, you could sell to a strategic at a high price and get just equity versus selling to someone like SaaS Group and get a cash. So it's very, very individual, right? It depends on whether you want to exit. Would you like to stay and continue growing? Are you big? Are you small? So a lot of times people ask us those questions and we're trying to basically quickly point them in the right direction. Of course, when you have a broker, if you're working with someone like Juan, usually the M&A advisor would already scope the market and give some valuation guide to the seller. So there, the question is really, are we the right buyer? Should we spend time on this opportunity? And we as SaaS Group spend a lot of time figuring out whether the business is the right ICP, because Juan can sell business to 20 different buyers. We just want to buy one specific business. And therefore, typically Juan would have a much better view on which buyer can offer the highest price. We can offer the highest price for if the company fits our ICP perfectly.
Okay, that's a very good answer. And it's really interesting how, you know, you mentioned that, well, everyone's asking, okay, how much is it going to be and how much I can sell my company for. And I had a podcast recently where that became a problem. So basically, that was the only question that founder has asked. And at the end of the day, they got fixated on the numbers so much that they just neglected everything else, like where the money was coming from and, you know, who the buyers are and if there is a fit. And at the end of the day, unfortunately, the deal fell through. So what to do if, you know, the number is too good? It seems like this is a dream coming true kind of exit. What kind of buyer due diligence would you recommend doing? Like, Pavel, do you actually see a lot of people coming to SaaS Group knowing what we do and, you know, where the money is coming from and stuff like that?
Well, I think by today we are almost 8 years old. We have transacted, I think, 23 times or 23, 25 times. We just announced one acquisition yesterday and we've done another one a week ago that is yet to be announced. I think when you're at that size, M&A firms like the one that Juan is running probably know us really well. They know that we're well-funded, have debt facilities, and therefore it's very unlikely that when we get approached by a new M&A firm or seller, they will be worried that we cannot close. I think the worry is that, you know, some things come up in due diligence, you're not able to validate your hypothesis, but when it comes to like ability to close, it's extremely high. Where I think you run into trouble is, you know, you have obviously a search fund class that's evolving. And we've seen a couple of situations where new searchers were bidding very high in a software company and they just couldn't raise money by the time they go to investment committee. Another situation would be a strategic buyer that, you know, a CEO decides to do a certain pivot. They put a very high price on the deal and then the board doesn't approve it, right? Or people that just don't have money or they're maybe acting as a broker. So in my experience, you know, for example, Juan will probably work a lot and try to figure out if this buyer is real. I would encourage buyers to do the same. Sorry, sellers to do the same. Really ask who you are, where's the money? Do you have a debt facility? Show us some documents to really get a proof that the buyer is real. But I think with someone like SaaS Group, that's really not an issue. We are backed by significant capital, debt facilities, and we also are highly, highly profitable and generating cash every month, meaning typically when we offer to a business, we do not have a financing contingency.
All right. Juan, what do you recommend the sellers do if they want to ensure that the deal will be happening?
Actually, there are a few things. First of all, 80% of the buyers we present our deals to are people who we trust and we know well and are in our network. And maybe the other 20% might be specific to the opportunity or the company that we're selling at the moment. So perhaps strategic buyers that are really relevant to them, but they might not be as close to us as others, like SaaS Group or other financial buyers. So I think generally, if you rely on an advisor, then there's chances that you're going to get buyers that are vetted or that are previously or have been previously screened. And obviously, we will never recommend that we engage with a buyer that has not obtained financing or that doesn't have the resources to complete the due diligence and so on. One of the things that we always request is we send a process letter to buyers and we ask them to explain in a lot of detail what type of due diligence they are going to perform, whether the financing is in place, whether they need additional approvals and so on. And so getting that offer with all that level of detail will give you a strong sense of the real intent of the buyer and the real capacity of the buyer to complete the deal. And then the other thing that I would say, and it also relates to the valuation, because in the end, we will never give them a number in terms of valuation. We will always give them a range. And it relates a lot to finding the right buyer. So perhaps Pavel, as he said before, he will be very aggressive in acquiring a specific type of business, but he will kind of neglect or don't look too much into businesses that don't meet their ICP so much. And that's where you maximize valuation and also find the right buyer. And the right type of buyer will give you signals that they're ready to close through the whole process. So I think, this type of thinking will give you a lot of info of the real buyer intent and whether they're serious or not.
All right. I remember once I wrote a blog post where it said how to price your company right. And Pavel pinged me on Slack and he was like, what is right, Anna? Like, can you explain to me what is right? And I was like, I don't know. What is right, Pavel? How do you recommend sellers to approach an acquirer with a price? Like, what to tie it to? Is there the right way to actually price your company when you're coming to an acquirer? Juan, what's your approach here?
Well, my take, I think in the end, when you're a founder, chances are maybe you have sold a company before, but chances are you're not gonna be an expert in valuation. You're an expert in running tech companies, right? So I think relying on someone who's done a lot of valuations and who has closed deals recently will give you a good sense of what type of valuation you're expecting. So generally, this will mean multiples. In the SaaS space, it could be revenue multiples or EBITDA multiples. And depending on the specific business and the specific buyer, you will get different multiples or different ranges, right? And someone who has or who is working on that and who's doing that all day will give you a much better sense. I think it also makes sense to compare. So you might go to Pavel directly and he will give you a valuation. Then we can give you a range based on our know-how and our knowledge. But you might also want to consult other advisors before engaging one to see how they're thinking in terms of valuation, what type of process they're thinking of in terms of buyers and so on. And with all that data, generally you will be knowledgeable enough of how much your business is going to be worth before engaging in serious conversations with buyers.
Yeah, that makes sense. Pavel, so what do you usually see? What sellers think is the right price for them?
Well, look, I recently, I think, did a post on LinkedIn about the pricing dynamics. And I think what a lot of times sellers don't realize that when you're selling the company, unless it's a strategic buyer that pays a crazy price because they are too late to market, then the buyer needs to be able to make money from the transaction. And we're seeing that a lot in bigger deals in private equity market, because in private equity market, you typically are selling 51% and you're reinvesting your proceeds at the valuation that you're selling, meaning that if you sold at a very high price, you actually risk losing the other half, right? Which is not the case in our deals. But nevertheless, sometimes sellers come to us and say, hey, you know, I want to sell this business for 20 times EBITDA, you know, and my company is growing only 5% a year. And then I'm sort of asking them, hey, you know, this is the return that I'm going to get. You know, do you think it's appropriate? You know, if you were buying your own company from someone else, would you pay that? And that somehow helps me ground the sellers. But look, the best thing for sellers to get grounded is to go and speak with our competitors, right? Because a lot of times people, say, I got approached by a buyer, but what does it mean, right? Does it mean you got an inbound email? Have you actually spoken with them? Have they done the DD? Have they put an offer? What are the terms of that offer? Is it stock? Is it all earnout? And really, the best thing you can do is to do an education and then come back to us. Because if you have a business that fits the right ICP that is growing, that is very lean, I can guarantee you that I'm going to offer you the best price in the market, right? If you have a business that is a strategic feature that Microsoft wants to buy, right? I'm not going to offer you the best, go talk to an advisor that knows Microsoft and they're going to give you the best price. So education, right? Know your worth, but also, don't be too aggressive, right? Make sure that you understand that buyers also need to make money just like yourself and try to factor that into your valuation.
Perfect. All right. Well, another thing to think about when you're approaching an exit, and I think that's something that we share a lot, is being prepared to really having an exit plan. So, what if you haven't really thought about it, right? You have been approached by an acquirer and you've never had an exit plan in your head. So what is there, like, a typical structure that acquirers offer? What should founders expect as a default option? Juan?
I think there's no such thing as a default option, because it depends a lot on the type of buyer you engage with and your business. But yeah, it's quite common that you get a part of the price upfront and a part of the price in deferred payments, and generally linked to performance. So that's something that we generally explain early on in the process. Then the other thing that we try to, and we like to engage with founders like very early on, like perhaps 1 year in advance before an exit, so that we first understand whether the deal is marketable, because sometimes there's things that need to be done in the company, like, for example, a succession plan, or maybe the metrics are not quite right, but if you focus a little on profitability or improving NRR, then you can make it. So that type of thing is something that we always like to prepare well ahead of time. And at the same time, we can also educate sellers in what type of structures, what type of deals they're going to get, even if there's not like a closed type of thing, but kind of it helps them set the expectations for the future. And they can start thinking of that while they run operations and so on. And then when they're ready to push the button, then there we are, and we help them through the whole process.
So it's not like there is this one structure that you would recommend basically to, say, 99% of the B2B SaaS founders.
I think, ultimately, it will depend a lot on whether you're going to stay, whether you're going to leave, because in the end, that will change a lot the type of structure. When you were willing to stay, you might make a lot of money by having deferred payments linked to performance. So if you're staying for 5 years, if you continue growing the business is going to be much more valuable in 5 years from now. And if you get deferred payments linked to that type of performance, then you're going to make much more money. But that might not be for everyone, because some people are looking for a quick transition. They want to leave in 1 or 2 years, and they focus more on cash upfront. But that's generally, there's always a mix between upfront and deferred payments. And depending on the type of business, the type of buyer, and so on, it will have to adapt to the deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Pavel, so what kind of deals do we usually do at SaaS Group? And I remember on Reddit, we had this question of whether or not full cash, just clean exit in 2 weeks with a bag of money is possible.
Super good question. We bought many different businesses. We bought businesses that had one person generating insane amount of profit. We also bought businesses that had 40 people, right? And now both of them are part of the SaaS group. And I would say that there are different issues with those different businesses. What we really like at SaaS Group, and I'll tell you how that links to preparation, we love businesses that run on autopilot. Usually it's one founder, maybe 2-3 employees working on code, maybe one person doing customer support. And we also like when founder is part-time with the business. And typically those businesses, they are built in a way, they're not built for sale, but if you think about it, they're extremely easy to sell because they basically usually don't do any marketing. They have automated billing in Stripe. Accounting is clean in QuickBooks. Everything is documented. They run on AWS. The code is okay, relatively up to date. And so when you buy those businesses, there's actually nothing that needs to be prepared compared to, say, when you are running maybe a more sales-led business where you as founder have a lot of industry contacts and a lot of the sales pipeline is driven by you. And when we see evidence of founder personality in every single part of the business, that to us is a red flag. And coming back to your question is when you have a business like that, where you cannot be taken out and you want to be taken out, right? So you're actually looking for a cash deal with a quick exit, then this is where you should start preparing a couple of years ago. Versus if you are sort of working 2 hours a day to answer questions, and then every couple of months you're doing a 24-hour coding sprint and your revenue is going 20% year over year, then I would argue you can just come to us and we'll give you a very, very quick exit. So very, very different situations. And yeah, the more people you have, the more embedded you are in operations, I would say the more time you need for preparation. And I would argue that the more complex your business, the more it lends to getting an advisor, someone like Juan, started maybe preparing a year before, cleaning up your deferred revenue recognition, cleaning up your org structure, preparing a successor, and getting someone, I think, professional really helps in those situations.
All right. I think we got, to a bit of understanding of what founders want and how advisors can help with that. But what do founders absolutely don't want? Like, what are the red flags and absolutely no-goes? Like, Juan, say you are approached by some buyers. Where do you say, okay, this is not what we want to work with, and we're probably not recommending companies that we're working with to you?
That's interesting. I think, many founders don't want to speak to their competitors, and they're totally right about it, because in the end, they're least likely acquirers, and they're just going to look at their data and probably continue the business because they might not add that much to the platform. It's mostly financial buyers that have like a mission of acquiring businesses, pretty much like SaaS Group, and also strategic buyers that are looking to increase their scope in terms of additional capabilities, additional features in the product. Those are the most likely ones. So sometimes it will make sense to engage with a competitor, and I'm not opposing that. And we sometimes include them in the list when there's a case or when it's a history of past engagements, for example. But the founders have like the right intuition in that direction. Let's not speak with competitors. Let's shelve them all until we have kind of gone through the whole list of potential buyers. And then maybe and only maybe we can speak.
Okay, that's very interesting. And Pavel, okay, on the side of the acquirer, what kind of founders we don't really want to engage with? What are the red flags for buyers?
Well, I would say founders that do something unethical, perhaps. I mean, you'll be surprised, but in software industry, you have a lot of businesses that appear very successful on the surface, right? They are growing, they have high profit, but they are doing things that are not entirely legal or things that are prone to a lot of lawsuits and litigation. And usually these are things that to do with personal data, how the personal data is being used and resold. And so I would say when we have a business that has such characteristics, we typically choose not to engage. But generally, we are extremely founder-friendly. We love all the founders. And so even if you don't like your business, we're going to tell you, hey, like this doesn't work for us, but here are a couple options because maybe there's a buyer that loves this kind of business, right? And I think that's the beauty of also of Juan's role that, he has opportunity to find a home for everyone, whereas we have to really stick to our ICP and just give honest feedback. And yeah, unfortunately, 99% of companies that come through our pipeline, they are not the fit, and we're really spending a lot of time looking for that, 1% perfect business for us.
Yeah, everyone's looking for the perfect match. All right, let's maybe talk a little bit about the due diligence process. I mean, we are now launching this course on M&A for founders, where we went through every little piece of due diligence. And it's, if I'm not mistaken, 70 videos of, you know, everything that, that founders can meet in this process. So it's quite long and very big deep dive into due diligence. So Juan, maybe you can tell the audience a little bit more what it is, what to expect, you know, what to be, you know, maybe concerned about, what is usually considered a big thing, but really isn't. So maybe a bit of an insight.
Yeah, this is probably the most feared part of closing a deal, right? And in the end, it's interesting because buyers are looking at LOIs, like offers from buyers, and in all that kind of process pre-due diligence. Sometimes they're even having fun, like, yo, we got several offers, we compare, it feels like a fun thing. And then we send them down the way directly into due diligence. And it feels like terrible, but it's not that terrible, actually. If you're well advised and if you have done your homework, it should be relatively easy. I think one of the obviously topics that are most intensive is financials. So financials, founders, again, tech founders are not that financially savvy. Some of them are, but in general, they don't need to be, and they just overlook that part. And so engaging with someone who's been doing deals in the past will help you get all these nuances right. And that's sometimes you're doing cash accounting and then there's no deferred revenue, there are no prepaid expenses, a few accounting things that need to be taken care of that will pop up in due diligence. Getting metrics right is also important. What's your net revenue retention? What are your users doing in terms of behavior plans, etc.? Having that database of users and revenue is also something that is really important. But again, if you're using a tool for tracking that, and it could be as simple as Stripe's subscription management tool, or it could be something like Paddle or Baremetrics or whatever, then you should be able to have that info like handy for buyers. I think generally buyers won't waste your time. They will just want to look into the things that are interesting to them. And they will look at it into a lot of detail to make sure that they're buying the right business, but it's not kind of crazy or they won't look into things that they shouldn't look into. And other than the financial part, which I think generally takes like 50% of the time, there's also looking at the tech stack, making sure that you don't have technical debt and that you have the right coding practices. They will want to understand about your team and learning whether they're contractors, whether they engage with the company, whether they are employees, whether they have like some sort of incentive to continue operating, whether some of them are critical and some of them are not that much of core for the team. All those things are important. And then I would say the more like compliance stuff, which is legal and tax matters, which is generally outsourced. And that's where the advisor generally engages with the accountants, with the tax advisors, to make sure that all that info flows well to the buyers. So I think, again, it will obviously take some time from the founder, but if you're working with someone who has done it before, it shouldn't be that stressful or that really dreadful as people paint it.
It's very interesting. I just want to point out, you said, you know, buyers don't want to waste your time. So at what point, you know, how long do you think the normal due diligence should take? And at what point should founders be like, huh, okay, maybe it's taking a bit longer and there is something going on?
Actually, buyers don't want to waste your time because they don't want to waste their time either, right? And they're quite busy, they want to acquire. It depends. I mean, I've seen buyers that are really practical and can wrap up a due diligence in 4 weeks. Sometimes I've seen that extended up to 2 months. I would say that's mostly the range, depending on if you're working with someone that is very, I would say, they have a lot of external investors and they need to comply with certain requirements and so on. It might take a little longer, but generally, if they're practical, they know what they're after. They bought similar businesses in the past. They will just look at the metrics that they need to understand, look at the cash flow, understand what the business is doing, how they're going to integrate and how they're going to run it going forward. And they will give you an answer in like 4-6 weeks, that type of thing.
Perfect. Pavel, what's happening from our side? So how is due diligence run and what is the maybe the longest part?
Yeah, look, in my process, due diligence starts from when we talk to the founder for the first time, when one of our originators asks questions, right? We're trying to qualify whether you are the right business for us, you are the right ICP. So asking questions, you know, what's your motion? How do you get customers? Is it self-service? Is it sales? How many people do you have? If you're a founder, are you part-time? Are you full-time? So we do a lot of due diligence that informs the initial offer. And when we submit an initial offer, we typically state a lot of assumptions, things that we have seen, things that we've liked about your business, and things that we don't like. Then due diligence continues into LOI. We have a whole pre-LOI due diligence where we typically verifying some of the metrics that Juan mentioned, like NDR, GDR, customer concentration, a cohort performance over time, also the quality of earnings, because the EBITDA is something that we use for valuation. So we just need to make sure that, you know, your revenue is deferred, you're not capitalizing R&D. If you are a founder that's full-time, you're paying yourself a market salary. So a lot of that is already done quite early before LOI. And the culmination of that is so-called pre-LOI presentation, where we let the founders or the management teams essentially pitch the opportunity to sell their business to us, to explain what the market is, how they're positioned in that market, etc. The reason why this is extremely important to us is that during this whole process, we're trying to come up with a hypothesis or investment thesis why we believe this is the right business for us to buy, right? So not only that this is an ICP, but actually this is the business that is hopefully positioned in the right place at the right time in the right market. And then we also have internal capabilities to do something with the business. And so once we've identified that and signed the LOI, usually it's an 8-week process. So it's more on the 2 months that Juan mentioned rather than 4. And we typically split the due diligence in 2 phases. The phase one is a bit more commercial, where we're seeking to validate a lot of the assumptions that we've made regarding the market positioning, the health of the customers. And the second stage is rather more legal and confirmatory, where we typically issue the draft APA and we start reviewing the employee contracts. And a lot of things, a lot of the findings that we find in that second stage, they are usually not going to kill the deal, but they are going to go into asset purchase agreement. So if your employees do not have IP assignment, we're going to ask for a special indemnity, right? If there are undisclosed bonuses, right, we might ask you to cover those bonuses through the purchase price adjustment, right? But the first 30 days is really validating what you told us about your business is true. And a big part of that is doing a voice of customer exercise or a customer survey, right? So if you told us that your solution is better than the market, we're actually going to get a consultancy firm, talk to your customers, and we're going to ask you, why did you buy? And if all the customers tells us, well, we buy you because it's the cheapest tool in the market, but it's actually not very good, this is where we start to have conversations with the founder about, you know, does our investment thesis still hold? And usually we give very open feedback, what we've seen, what your customers have said, and so on and so on. And between those 2 phases, depending on various reasons why we like the opportunity, we can also do a tech DD. For example, if we see a very high risk, or we think that this is a very good technology that we're buying, and part of that technology will be used to sustain a competitive advantage into the future, that means that in those 30 days, we're also going to do a source code audit and really confirm that, hey, you have the best technology in the market. So, but usually within 8 weeks, I can guarantee that we would be able to do it. Where I think we have delays is where founders are somewhat unprepared and it takes a while to set up the data room. So everybody's anxious to sign an LOI on Friday. And then on Monday, we realize there's no data room. The employment agreements are all over the place. You have to talk to your tax accountant who is on holiday in Germany or somewhere else. And therefore, these 8 weeks may end up being 10 weeks. But usually for us, I guarantee whether it's the founder or the sell-side advisor that if we say it's going to be 60 days, we are going to do it within 60 days.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Well, I don't know. You might estimate this this question. Probably it's about AI, and you know, if there is a shift in, you know, in valuations and what acquirers are asking for buying companies that are in the AI space, how founders that are building with AI or adding AI to their product are pricing their companies. I think one of the LinkedIn posts that I saw was something like 2023 AI companies were trading for about 200 X multiple, and then in a year it went down to 47. So is that realistic? Juan, what do you see?
I think at this stage we're starting to see the first cohorts of AI powered businesses that get to exits, right? In the end, most of these newly formed companies that are kind of raising money now or growing or scaling are not mature enough for a sale. But it's interesting because we have a mandate now of a company in which AI is a relevant component of what they're building. And the way buyers we're talking to are perceiving this is fine. This is a competitive advantage, given that you build something that relies on a technology that is somehow harder to replicate. So you got the upper hand there. But ultimately, to what extent that does it mean that you would really summon or command a higher multiple compared to other products? So I think at this stage, the buyers that we're speaking to are reluctant to factor a premium just because the product relies on AI or there's an AI component in that aspect. But I think it's still early in this aspect. Again, most of the companies that have AI capabilities are just starting to operate, they're growing, the scaling, and there are few exits in that space that are happening at the moment.
Pavel, what do you see? Do we get approached by AI powered companies, and are their expectations real?
Yes, first of all, yes, to answer, we are approached by AI companies, and I think we were approached by AI companies before ChatGPT came out. I remember there were some tools like that help you write the job spec. I mean, it sounds a bit ridiculous right now, right? When I say it, but like 3 years ago, there was a tool that was like, wow, this is crazy. You could like generate a job spec, and they were very profitable and growing. And then ChatGPT came out, and a lot of these tools, they disappeared. So we are a SaaS group. I don't think we are extremely qualified to make a judgment call on which AI tool would work out. So we prefer to stick to the traditional software. But I think what we're seeing a couple things. So one of them, we are seeing companies that are going to serve the AI-enabled industry, right? So there are certain, like, for example, we closed a business that hasn't been announced yet, but it's in the API market. And that company not only is getting a lot of leads from the AI tools like Cursor, Lovable, but we also expect that their service will be needed more and more as AI penetrates a lot of the different markets. Similarly, we're seeing businesses that are doing maybe a traditional use case, but that use case is getting amplified by AI, so they're winning a lot of business, right? So for us, it's a positioning, right? It's not an AI product, but AI companies are going to use that product. And thirdly, I think we're starting to see software companies where AI agents are embedded. So let's say instead of, I don't know, two customer support reps, you have one or one and a half, right? Instead of maybe two marketers, you have one marketer with an AI agent. And that's just maybe tells us where the market is heading, right? There will probably be certain efficiency gains. But for those businesses, we would not give them a higher. I mean, okay, they will get a higher revenue multiple, but EBITDA multiple would still be the same because profit is profit at the end of the day. Where I think we would not pay a premium at this point of time is where a very legacy software business comes to us and we're saying, hey, we could actually, you know, make replacements here. We could replace half of the staff with AI. I think that still hasn't been proven to work. And so we would still give them a multiple of EBITDA based on the profit they generate today rather than at some point in the future.
All right. Okay, I think as we're coming to an end, I just have a couple more questions. And, you know, I think the one that is always there, apart from what is data room, is how to choose an acquirer. Like, what are we going after? Should it be strategic? Should it be someone like SaaS Group? Should we actually approach our customers or competitors? I had a call recently with the founder, definitely not a fit for SaaS Group, but wanted some kind of an advice of who to sell to. And they were only looking for a strategic founder, strategic acquirer, sorry, and never even thought about going after a more of a traditional PE kind of situation. So how to not overlook a good opportunity and how to choose the right one? Juan, what's the advice from the advisors?
I think you have to be a little open-minded. In the end, you shouldn't close any doors at the beginning of the process. Sometimes, you know, founders have this idea of strategic buyers will pay a higher multiple and financial buyers will pay a lower one. Actually, it's not always the case. And in the last two processes that we run, strategic buyers placed offers on the table, but they were below financial buyers. There are a number of considerations for what type of buyers you should seek. It also depends on whether you want to stay longer, whether you're still bullish on the business, whether you just want to kind of move on and give someone else the ability to continue the product, whether you don't care so much about that and so on. So depending on all those considerations, then you should choose one path or the other. And it's pretty much tailored. So for example, we ran a process for a travel marketplace, and that was completely geared towards strategic buyers. But then there was this other business that really didn't make sense for strategic buyers because in the end, it was too small for the companies that were relevant for this particular product. And so the clear winner was going to be financial buyers. And sometimes financial buyers might end up giving you a somehow clean exit. You just have to commit to a couple of years of transition, find someone else that will end up replacing you. So again, I think you should be open-minded, rely on your advisor who has seen many businesses in your vertical ideally and knows the space. And I'm not talking about B2B SaaS, but I'm talking about marketing tech or even kind of with more precise detail of a specific niche. And with that know-how, they will be able to tell you whether you should focus on this type of buyer or the other type.
Okay. So, Pavel, what type of sellers should be looking at SaaS Group, and who would we not want there?
You give me a great idea. We should almost have like a decision tree where, like, hey, where are you from, right? Which country? What's your size? How many employees? Yeah, I think Juan raised a lot of points, right? And maybe to answer like question you had before, right? When somebody says they only look in the strategics, right? I'm also curious why, right? Do they know? Because if you used to work at like a big strategic and you know they need this particular feature, or is it because you are like the tiny little tool that looks like MailChimp? I mean, MailChimp not going to buy you. I mean, they probably get your MRR in a day, right? So you have to be realistic. You have to do a lot of education. But I would say that when we talk to people, they ask us, hey, why SaaS Group? Why not private equity? Well, the truth is you are often too small for private equity, right? Private equity doesn't want to buy 2 million AR business. Their portfolio companies very often would, but they also, nobody wants to buy, if you're running, say, a sales marketing software, nobody wants to buy 50 employees. People want to buy revenue and not buy the people, right? And so there are a lot of different considerations that you have to consider when looking at different buyers. I would say for SaaS Group, what we really like, so if you're operating a highly profitable and capital efficient business, meaning ideally you're able to grow your revenue 10-15% with net dollar retention between, you know, 85 and 100% with zero marketing and very limited headcount, I would say this is the most ideal business to us. And you'll be surprised, but a lot of acquirers, they like to buy businesses with offices, with people, doing things, talking to customers. We are the opposite, right? We love indie hackers. There are often introverts. They don't like to talk to customers, so they actually build businesses that run by themselves, grow by themselves, have incredibly lean code. And we buy those companies, we give you a very short exit, and then I'm going to put my best people and I'm going to grow that business, right? And this is where I think we have the best fit. And then you go a little bit to the left, you have a little bit more people, a little bit less efficient, you go to the right, where perhaps you have certain issues like a legacy technology, perhaps your growth is not 20%, but it's 5%, and we can still find. But I would say that if you're in that screaming middle that I mentioned, then you should drop everything and you should go and talk to us straight away.
Right now. Great pitch. But okay, that was really, really great. Thank you both for, you know, for answering all those questions. I think it brought a lot of clarity to exiting a SaaS business. Just one thing, you know, because I always ask it at the end of every podcast, if you can share a hack. So anything that worked for, say, for founders that sold to with you, Juan. So I don't know, one thing that every other founder neglects to look at when they're choosing the right acquirer, or anything at all that you think will help other founders on that journey.
I think I would say make sure that you're connecting personally with the people that you're talking to, because in the end, you're going to be working with them for at least 1 year, maybe 3 years, maybe 5 years. You don't want to be locked. I mean, maybe you have a lot of cash in your bank account, but you're going to be locked with those people. So if it doesn't feel right, then you shouldn't continue. And sometimes it's just a gut feeling. I would say that's the best hack I could give at the moment.
That's a really good one, Pavel.
I think to expand on what Juan said, I think there's a big difference between founder being a number in the pipeline and founder being a real person that everybody wants to connect, right? Just remember that SaaS group and any other buyers, they have pipeline, right? They are NDDs. And so if you feel like your business deserves attention, you also have to do a bit of work, right? Don't expect people to run after you, because a lot of times, right, the pipeline is kind of like this. And so you have such a limited attention all the way to the top. And if you really feel like you found the right buyer, just make sure that you articulate that, be persistent, follow up quite aggressively with the buyer to make sure that your particular case is shifted all the way to the top. And actually, I heard once one of the influencers that exited the business also mentioned that if you're selling a strategic and you're not able to talk to a decision maker on the second call, just walk away. You're wasting your time, right? And so just make sure that you're not just talking to somebody junior, but also you are seeing more and more senior people, especially if you're talking to a strategic, right? You're talking to decision maker inside of 2-3 calls.
Perfect. And maybe I can also add to this, because at some point last year, I did interviews with all the founders that ever sold to SaaS Group. And I always ask them, okay, what stood out? And they would, like, each of them would mention either Dirk or Pavel or Tim Schumacher or somebody just kind of hand-holding them through the process and being on the call at any time and just kind of building that relationship, making sure that, okay, everything, we're here for you. So I think the relationship and that bit of trust that you're building during the process is really important. So I second what you guys just said. But yeah, thank you so much for this conversation. I think it's been really great. We have this live and we have this post on LinkedIn. So if anybody wants to add questions, feel free to do that. Juan, what's the best way to find you if people want an advice?
I think they should look into our website, perhaps l40.com. And there you have the team, and then you can contact us directly.
Or you can meet Juan in Bucharest in a couple of weeks at How to Web and our dinner.
Definitely.
Pavel, what's the best way to contact you?
On LinkedIn, email Pavel at SaaS Group. We have an online form, or you could contact any of the 6 members of the M&A team, as well as any of the founders. All emails usually come to M&A team, including info@saas.group. So yeah, if you want to sell, or if you want to just talk about selling your business or get some advice, just reach out anytime.
Cool. Thank you so much. And I think we'll wrap it up here, but hope we get to do it again sometime.
Great.
Likewise. Thank you, Anna.
Take care.